Hello, lovely listeners, and welcome back to On Becoming, the podcast that sheds light on the untold transformation stories of inspiring women creators, leaders, and entrepreneurs. This is the last interview of the season, and this conversation is so rich that I feel like it's one that I'll be coming back to over and over again as my metamorphosis continues, which you will get the reference to in about 10 minutes. So my guest today is Melissa Unger. She's an author, artist, and creative director. She's also one of my wisest and dearest friends, the woman with a philosophically punk aura, who has the wisdom, poise, and optimism of someone who has spent many more years on this earth than her 56 years. She's an aberrescent communicator, and talking with her stretches your mind into lands that you never knew existed. So Melissa and I met when I was working for Yelp in around 2011, and I was always on the prowl for cool new businesses in Paris. So my friend Mark Grossman, who's also a New Yorker and who has this fantastic chain of bagel stores called Bob's Juice Bar, told me to check in on her new space, Seymour, which was just across the road. I literally headed right across the street and knocked on the door, thinking that the space was already open. But then Melissa opens the door wearing overalls, covered in paint, and is like, oh, hey, we're literally painting the walls, but come back when we're open. When I showed up for Seymour a couple weeks later, I was completely blown away by the space. So after working for nearly 20 years in film, music, and art, assisting some of the biggest names in the business, Melissa created Seymour, an intentional space to help us literally see more of ourselves. The idea was to create a digital detox spa where you checked your phones at the entrance, picked up some paper and some pencils, and then explored the space to give your mind and your spirit targeted workouts. The clean loft-like design was divided into these different areas that each had some kind of exercise that would allow you to discover a different part of your identity. There was a photo booth where you could draw your own portrait, a cinema room where you could sit back and project whatever thoughts and fears were bubbling up onto the screen. And my favorite, the room filled of these giant red velour chairs that were facing different parts of the space where you could just imagine ideas floating towards you. It was revolutionary. And in a way, a victim of its own success, with Melissa's vision making its way into literally every hot magazine and newspaper. Then, in 2015, when Paris fell into a collective state of terror, shock, and grief, after the Charlie Hebdo terrorist attack in early January and then the Bataclan devastating terrorist attack in November, Melissa's Seymour was overflown with broken souls looking for a place to connect and heal. Melissa tried to carry it all, embrace all the suffering, fix it. But over time, she realized that there was a lot of her own healing that she needed to do. And despite Seymour's success, she felt that it was time to close the space and move back to New York, where she hadn't been for over a decade. She felt it was time and that she was ready to face some of the darkest parts of her past. So she's been back in New York. She arrived a few months before the pandemic. And once she got there, she decided to give herself the space and time to practice watercolor. And she published each day a little bit of what she was doing on Instagram. And watching the evolution has been absolutely mesmerizing because it's morphed into an actual mature artistic career, replete with gallery shows, commissions, and guest speaking gigs. But as always, there's more to the story. And in this conversation, Melissa's open up about how she's gone through some of the darkest days of her life since returning back to New York, shedding the thick musculature of her overachieving, overperforming approach to life, and embracing the icky, ugly phase of navigating the in-between as she evolves into a more peace-seeking and easeful creator. This conversation is a message of hope and love to anyone who has masked their fears behind their ambition. It's for work addicts who, despite their exhaustion, can't seem to give themselves a break. It's an inspiring story about putting our arms down and giving ourselves the space and time to not only truly get to know ourselves, to see ourselves, but to design a life that just feels better each day. As always, you can send me your feedback at ziva@zivabilel.com, or you can leave me a voice message, I love them, at speakpipe.com/onbecoming. Enjoy. Welcome to the show, Melissa. I'm so excited to have you here with me today.
I'm so happy to be here.
Whenever I think about you, I think about someone who has a very, very strong, intuitive, creative impulse connection and flow. I've always been fascinated by your process. And sometimes you use words that I don't quite understand because it's not relatable to my experience, but I know that it's something that you feel in a visceral way. So I'm excited to talk to you today about how you've created that, connection to your intuitive creative flow, and even go back to when it first appeared in your life. On this show, what I love to present to listeners is the journey that we take to become who we are, because I feel like we don't hear so much about the difficult moments when it was hard to make a decision or there was an urge to do something and it didn't really seem logical. So that's what I'm excited about talking about. What are you excited about looking more closely into in terms of your journey today?
Well, it's interesting when I hear you talk, because that journey is something that I've talked about a lot in the last 10 or 15 years. What's really alive for me today, and if I were to share something with people, even with On Becoming, is, and as hackneyed as it sounds, is that it's really all possible in the moment. So it's like, I felt a resistance in me when you were asking that. I was like, oh my God, I have to go back and like tell the whole story again. And it's weird. It feels like that person is obviously still me. And at the same time, she's not me. And something in the journey to where I am now, that need for self-disclosure or the expression of every moment, I realize in retrospect, for me, was a form of panic and a form of need to justify my actions in some weird way. That doesn't mean we end the podcast here. There's lots to talk about.
And goodbye.
And thank you. But do you know what I mean a little bit? How does that land for you?
Well, I mean, there are a couple things that I'm thinking about that I'm picking up on is like, A, you use the word resistance. And so that's always exciting to explore the resistance. Like, what is that resistance about? And also this idea of shedding identities along the process, like along the journey. And maybe you don't feel connected to or the need to really even talk about that woman, that girl from the past, because she doesn't feel relevant to where you are today?
Well, it's interesting because I don't feel the need to talk about her for sure, but I will for the sake of this. But even this conversation, I think, is interesting, like in its context. But I don't think she's not relevant. I think she's relevant. So I think those things, it's like, I don't feel the need to talk about her and she's very relevant because without her, there's no me, right? So it's like very, very boring, basic analogy of a butterfly and a caterpillar. But the caterpillar, I feel very disidentified from that. I'm a completely different creature now, let's say. But without that beginning, I couldn't be where I am. So I have tremendous interest in her and tremendous capacity to like love her and be interested in her. But I do feel less identified with her. But she's important because every single step that you're talking about, every choice at every juncture, I think that's something that I'd probably like to share if anyone's beginning the journey, is that it's not this moment where you're like, even though I had a somewhat transcendental experience, it's not like, oh my God, now I'm connected. You know, it's like, it's really, for me, it was checking in with myself in full consciousness at every moment with the goal of getting out of the pain that I was in a natural, positive way. And I think what's interesting is I didn't choose the easy route. Sometimes each one of those decisions, I was actually more painful, but my higher goal was the freedom from that pain, if that makes any sense. So sometimes people misunderstand, think that spirituality or is like rainbows and it's like going toward the ease and fall. It is, but it's an ultimate ease of freedom that sometimes you have to go through the shitty part.
Right. So it sounds like there's like, maybe there's also the definition of what the intuition versus maybe some kind of higher calling or a higher truth. I've always had somewhat of a difficult time with even the term intuition because there's this belief that intuition is evidence. It's like obvious to you where right. sometimes what's obvious is maybe an accumulation of old layers that makes something feel natural and normal, mm-hmm. where there might be something that's beyond that, that we have to get to somehow that requires some kind of work or some kind of effort.
So let's lose the word intuition and higher self because they're coded and loaded. Let's say there's a part of you whose job is to keep you safe. And that is the human condition. There's a very dominant sort of inbuilt operating system that's like, I need to be safe. And as we are born and grow, we have experiences. And if we get hurt, we then attribute and we're like, that's not safe. And so that's how our personalities get built based on our different experiences. It's like safe, not safe, safe, not safe. Then I won't try it again. So sometimes if we've been hurt in doing something that was good for us. So for instance, in my case, if I had early broken connections between family members, I would say, well, it's not safe to connect with people. Right. And so then my intuition would be like, people are not safe, which of course is not true. I think that there's the aspect of our life experiences and our natural propensity subconsciously even to just be safe, which sometimes keeps us trapped. Mm-hmm. And then there's, for this conversation, let's call it the higher self, like where the field in which all possibility exists prior to life experiences that deform our lens of what's safe and what's not. And then another thing that's coming to me, the notion of thinking versus feeling. Mm-hmm. And when you and I were hanging out a lot, I was in a place of thinking my way out of things and lots of knowledge and lots of mental stuff and reading and learning and whatever. And which is, has its place. The pedagogic aspect that I went through on my journey to understand intellectually was extremely important for me, not for everyone. Now I'm in a more feeling place. And things shifted for me in recent years when I started to really think about how I wanted to feel in my life. Mm. And some people need exhilaration. Some people need success, but I'm 56. And for me, at this stage of my life, I want harmony and safety more than anything. And I want a sense of peace. So I make every decision based on that sense of balance and harmony. So I'm still ambitious. I still have all my projects. I'm even working on bigger things than I had in the past. But I am guided by a notion of peace and calm is my headline, mm-hmm. which enables me to tap into self-care, which was something I really struggled with in my life. I always put myself last. I was very burnt out. I was always ragged, always exhausted. And people talk to me about self-care. And I was just like, yes, I know. And I'd go for a massage or I'd start to eat better. And none of that stuck. And it didn't start to stick until I prioritized peace and harmony. And so now it's natural. If I'm tired, I have to cancel. Or if I'm working on a project and it's becoming too exigent or the dynamic in the group is not working. It doesn't mean I throw down my crayons and like walk away. It just means that there's like a mild little thing that goes off and then I reset.
So, all right, what I'm getting is there are lots of versions of you that were operating more from a default of using past experiences that were maybe painful as a way to navigate connections, decisions, goals, projects. Mm-hmm. And you're looking for validation or looking for that safety, self-value. And then you got to a point, and this is maybe where we can kind of start to dig, where you realize that you didn't have to do it that way, that there was another way to feel your way to what was a kind of life that had less of that pursuit of tangible, extrinsic value, and operate in a place where it's more about feeling safe and feeling calm and feeling peaceful. And that's now your playbook that you use to make decisions.
It is. And you used a really important word that like leapt out at me when you said it. It's pursuit. Mm. I feel like I spent, maybe it's because I'm a born and bred New Yorker. It wasn't until I lived in France for 15 years that I realized that, I mean, you know it intellectually, but you don't really fully understand the meaning of a capitalist society until you live outside of it, right? So even though I was always half American, half French, and spent a ton of time in both countries, I intellectually understood what socialism was, and I intellectually understood what capitalism was. But I don't think that I understood to the profound degree that I do now how much a capitalist culture, particularly an extremely capitalist culture like the United States, affects the literal cognitive development of children, or like each, even my most liberal sort of socialist leaning, for lack of a better word, non-wealth accumulating friends that are American are still in a deeply ingrained competitive mindset. And if it's not about money, that competition and pursuit gets translated into something else. And that pursuance, that perpetual, it's never enough. There's more. There's always someone that has more. Like I noticed when I moved to the United States, there's, granted, it was the pandemic and all sorts of why, it's a very wild time to make any sort of extrapolation about a culture because it was like such a bananas time. But I think it existed even before the pandemic. As a New Yorker, most people in New York, and we can't say America because New York is not America, but in New York, where we joke, we say everyone here is a main character. It's like there's a type of personality.
That's like, you're just like, New York is not America. It's fact.
It's not, for better or for worse. It's better and worse. It's not America. It's its own little, but is this notion of it's never enough. So it's always like you're living in the apartment you're living in for now, but you're going to have the next thing. And you're in the job that you're in for now, but you're going to have the next thing. And then you're in the, and so there's this perpetual, it's like really hard to just like chill with people, to just be like, like at all socioeconomic strata, to just be like, come on over and just like hang, you know what I mean? And I was definitely one of those people. I'm not pointing fingers. Like I was 100% one of those people. And there was a big dissonance when I moved back and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And for inside me, and part of it was that in France, there's a lot of hanging out.
This subject I think is fascinating and we don't talk about it enough. And it's something that you and I have both experienced as New Yorkers who have lived extensively in France and Europe. This capitalistic culture shock that occurs when you are not getting the same cues from your environment about what you should be concerned about and what you should be pursuing. But you decided, this is what I find so fascinating, is after having gone from New York and that culture, and having that been your modus operandi for so many years, to then go to France where it was a different pool that you were swimming in. How was it for you to then decide to come back? And what's the re-immersion been for you after having been away from that for so long?
Right. So let's make sure that we orient back toward how those cultures affect our decision-making as human beings, as opposed to getting into which is better, which isn't better, which is whatever. What I would say is this competition that New Yorkers or the capitalist countries feel is because everything is so expensive and you feel like you have to constantly grind. And I feel like that's changing a little. So it's not a judgment. It's just a different thing. The only reason I brought it up really was that whether it's me being there or the opposite, you don't realize that you're in it, what it is, until you have a perspective on it. And it's that same thing that we were talking about earlier. There's the intellectual perspective, and an educated American understands the difference between capitalism and socialism and vice versa. But in terms of the felt experience of everyday operations, like in your body and in your life, you don't really realize what that means when you just go on vacation or like go on when you live somewhere. You see the difference. So in Europe and Italy, it's like give a piano vasano. Those who go slowly go in health. And then there's the midday lunches and the, you know, so all of those things impact like who we are. Then conversely, I arrived as an American filled with ambition and used to taking care of business. And I was not encouraged by the French. It was very vulgar. It was seen as wanting more for myself than was appropriate. I was like the brown noser because I was working hard and it wasn't celebrated. I think I went to France without really knowing all of this intellectually, but feeling that I needed a break, I would say. So there's a part of me that was probably telling myself, it will be easier and less competitive in France, although I don't think that I articulated that to myself at the time. It was more just a break and a change. And then conversely, when I came back, in some way, I knew I was coming back to clean up some unfinished business within myself here.
Okay.
And I know we decided not to use the word intuition, but I did have an intuition that it was the French chapter was over for that moment. And I felt that there were some childhood things and wounds that I had run from that I now felt strong enough to address. And I was right.
Mm-hmm.
I did do that while I was here during the pandemic, went through a dark night of the soul, so to speak. So if we're in our cheesy metaphor, in between stage between the caterpillar and the butterfly is not pretty. I mean, I always joke, it's like, that's why they encase it in like the pupa. Because ain't no one want to see that shit. You know what I mean? It's like, that full decomposition of one entity into sludge while it like rebuilds itself into another is not pretty. It is just gross. And I definitely experienced that in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And it is... if anybody is going through that in different language, keep going. If there's one thing in this podcast that shows up, it's that phrase, when you're going through hell, keep going. Like, just keep going. Because if you're in hell and you're in the fire and you stop, just keep going. The next day is always a new opportunity and keep going. And when I was in that state, I was like, I don't know. It was just really painful, like to look at all of the hard things. I had a shrink once that said something to me that I thought was really useful in a very clear metaphor. She's like, if you're in a car and you don't want to go back and you don't want to go, you don't know. She's just like, just pull over. Like you just pull over for a second, put it into neutral and just sit there for a minute until you're ready to make a decision if you want to go forward or back again. There's always the neutral. And I think we live in a culture, be it in France or in the United States, where the neutral has been completely forgotten. We always have to be active. It's like front or reverse.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a couple of things that are coming up for me. One of the things that happens with my clients is that they start the process of sketching out in very broad strokes a feeling they want to have in the future that requires some work because there are some things that need to be changed, but it's not clear exactly what that is yet. A lot of what reveals itself pretty quickly is that they're operating from a very limited belief system about what is possible for them and how they can show up and who they can be. And so we have to dig around and make some adjustments to those belief systems. The beginning is exciting because there's a big moment of, I didn't see this before. This is really new. You feel like suddenly you're now standing above the situation. But there's a point in the middle where things get really scary and ugly because the new system hasn't been designed yet. They're operating from like a no longer where I was, but not yet where I'm going. And it's like kind of that, I think of like that, it was like Indiana Jones, you know, that bridge, you get into the middle of the bridge, the wood planks behind are starting to crumble. You just don't know whether or not can you go back to where it was safe, but you don't want to be there anymore because what's beyond that is so unknown. It's that middle ground. It's that space of the in-between.
That resonates 100%. That's exactly right. And I feel like I just went through that. And that's just perfectly articulated. I mean, that's exactly it. And this in-between is what would be great to destigmatize in culture. This unknowing of where you're going, this uncertainty, this liminal state, you know, that you just described, is pathologized in our culture. It's like you either have to feel great, or if you don't feel great, we need to know, we need to label it, pathologize it, and say why it's not great, and then fix it so that we can get you to great, right? So you're either in the shit or you're in the great. And then when you're shit, you're like, let's whatever that is to fix so that we can get you back to great. It's like our culture tolerates one of those two states. But the juicy state is that in-between state. I learned a word a couple of years ago that I didn't know called fallow, letting a field lie fallow, which is for good crops. If you are constantly turning the soil or you turn it too much or too quickly, you are sometimes, think of the metaphor for our personal growth, pulling up the roots of something that is trying to grow because you're at a different pace that you have decided in your limited mind, it should happen in this time and whatever, and it's not happening. So try another thing. But you're accidentally uprooting the thing that's trying to grow.
Right.
And letting a field lie fallow is letting a whole cycle, a whole crop cycle go with nothing on that field. But that doesn't mean that something isn't happening below the surface. So in terms of our personal growth, what I endured for myself these last few years had been a period where things were changing a lot below the surface, but you couldn't necessarily tell. And I had, as a decades-long overachiever, to learn to let my field life out, like to feel what that was like. And then I know last time you and I were together, we talked a lot about mind-body top-down versus bottom-up. And the big new journey for me has really been listening to my body. And I'm still learning that. It's a whole new vocabulary. And just like going, leading with that kind of embodied awareness, mm-hmm. which feels alive in the moment. And I would just sit. And so I did a lot of just sitting with my discomfort. And that self created a larger window of tolerance for me to, in my case, not do anything, right? Whereas for other, some people are underactive when they need the exact opposite. They need a kick in the ass and, you know, whatever. For me, it was like I was overactive and my addiction was work. Like my way to not feel pain was to constantly be doing. Now I get to feel very clean emotions, like actual grief, actual sadness. When you feel them without the egotistic self-flagellation on top of them, they're part of the human condition. They're beautiful. They're like music notes.
There are a couple of things that I'm loving about this. When you are talking about having the overachieving instinct, like the overdeveloped overachieving muscle that is your go-to. And whenever there is discomfort, and there's always going to be discomfort in our lives, right? But then you're maybe also sitting on a pile of discomfort that hasn't been addressed too from past things.
Yes, 100%.
It goes like that becomes the pattern. You've used it. You go right into autopilot of the overachieving. You get 48 hours off. It doesn't matter. You're not going to relax. You're just going to build a castle. That's the way that you are not feeling the things that you have been told you shouldn't feel, or maybe by experience, it's probably best to stay away because that's dangerous.
Yes.
If you go there. And so that just becomes the life that you live. Your life is about overachieving. But then you get to a place where you are allowing yourself to feel the nuances of all the different human emotions. And I love that. It's reminding me of your, you know, your palette of colors, right? You can't just be in pastel land and have something that's interesting. You have to also think about contrast. You have to think about if you play with different textures, like that is ultimately what our life experience, quote unquote, should be about. It's allowing ourselves to have a full range of human emotions. But if we're always keeping ourselves numb to the sadness, the grief, the disappointment, the frustration, and trying quickly to get out of it, we can't really access what's behind it, or what is it masking? Are there other things that need to be addressed? This kind of like the mucky in between zone, the funky caterpillar junk zone. But I know that Seymour was a space, like this liminal space, for people to kind of go into those in between zones and to bring to the surface without having a particular goal in mind, just to be able to access these areas of oneself that modern life disallows us from having access to because we are in the speed of technology and getting to work. So you arrived at this yourself, but you also created a space for people to start exploring that. Now, in hindsight, like when you say where you are today, do you feel like you were close enough to being in that in-between, in that neutral space when you created Seymour?
Well, I would say a couple of things to answer that. One, the color palette is very interesting that you chose because when I was doing Seymour, everything was black and white. So that's very indicative of the I'm feeling great or I'm feeling shitty, right? It's like that, but and there's none of the color in between. You can't open the other colors if you don't feel safe, because you're either in a mask, which is everything's fine, or completely shut down, right? And I vacillated between those two spots for most of my life. When I started to allow room for that discomfort, the color started to come. If you are someone that fears your emotions, I remember distinctly having like a little voice way, way, way back many, many years ago that was keeping me safe, or thought it was keeping me safe, which was the little girl in me that felt that if I opened the door to those emotions and I felt them, I would never get up. Like I thought they would just flatten me. I was so afraid. I had so much unprocessed pain like jammed into a closet. You know how it's like you open the closet and like everything falls down on you.
Mm-hmm.
I felt certain that I was safer with that door closed than I was with opening it. And I thought that I would absolutely never survive the opening of that door. And I think a lot of people that are disconnected from themselves and a lot of people in my life that I've like that my story that I've had trouble connecting to is people that feel safer in that sort of denial of that emotion. And we have to respect that. Like people know themselves. If they feel like they are going to be taken under by the opening of that door, we must respect them and let them keep that door closed. I reached a point in my life where I had built enough resiliency for myself, enough resourcing, inner resourcing, outer resourcing, that made me feel that I could start to crack open that door. Mm-hmm. But until I had those things, I did not feel. And then added to that, once I opened the closet, it wasn't like a Willy Wonka rainbow came out. All the heavy shit fell on top of me in this caterpillar stage. And I had to deal with that to get to this sort of harmony. So I don't believe in sugarcoating it for people. It's definitely hard work and a brave undertaking,
yeah.
But it's absolutely worth it. And what helped me was that I had done it in a mini version before and I had survived it, so to mm-hmm. speak, and up-leveled. So I knew that I would and I would go again. So to answer the question with regards to Seymour, yes. Back then, in that previous incarnation, the Seymour space was the highest expression of my expansion that was possible in that moment. And so I then shared that with others that were also arriving at that same juncture. And obviously, as we know, it resonated tremendously with people that were at that juncture. And part of why I left and closed was that I knew I was entering into another cycle, right? And we're working on another Seymour project that's bigger and that will hopefully get done. There's a lot of moving parts. So if it's meant to be in the world, it'll be in the world. And it now brings a secondary component, which I did not have. So to make it really basic, let's call the Seymour space was about mind. And then I learned about body and embodied. So this new offering will be a combination of both. And then I would imagine that in future years, that duality will no longer be a necessary teaching tool. And there will be some sort of unity and integration. But the Seymour space in Paris, the way you described it, is very good. It was really the beginning. It was mm-hmm. like, just at least give yourself the time to consider opening that door, that closet door.
Right.
And let me give you a handful of tools for when you start opening that closet door so that you're not like, let me give you a helmet, like a pencil. Let me give you a couple of navigation tools, a compass, a machete, a pen, a map. Let me give you a couple of things that are going to help you in this jungle. Like when you open.
Right.
And then this next space will add on the more embodied experience.
Seymour was the offering that you were able to materialize based on the journey that had gotten you to that point. And it was where you were residing in your mind and in your process.
Yes.
And It was a place that, like, you had to go through there in order to be with this new iteration today, like, because it had to come out of you somehow. Some people go through their metamorphoses and they don't necessarily have to use the connection with others as a way to process that phase, that era. So when I think about what you're talking about with Seymour, it's like you're at this place in your own process, but you also design a space that's going to connect with other people who are having a similar need for that. And it's by having a space that is a community, really, that you can move to the next stage in your own evolution. But it's because you create something. two, you create an offering.
Once a very perspicacious journalist came in and she said to me in French, "Vous avez construit l'espace Simor et l'espace Simor vous a construit." So she said, you built the Simor space and the Simor space built you. So that speaks like literally to what you were talking about. It, in my case, as a maker and as an artist, it is in the doing, in the making, that helps me process. I also think that the root of my issues are relational. So I've been working on not using the word trauma as much because it's been overused in culture lately. But let's say my trauma is a relational trauma. So I can only heal my trauma in relation. Not everybody has that, but for me, that's what I'm healing. And I also think that there's part of my original wound that is about being misunderstood and not seen for who I feel I am on the inside and not accepted. And so a lot of the living out loud and evolving out loud that I was doing, which was probably unconscious, was just like being me, so that there's nothing hidden. The adult me was teaching, you know, in anything, like you learn something. And if you're generous of heart, you feel like it's useful, you want to teach it, you teach it. The artist in me learns better through actually making. The little girl in me that was healing probably very much needed to be seen and understood and was seeking her own understanding of herself.
I talk about your watercolor practice all the time to my clients as an example of starting small and repeating the practice without necessarily knowing where it's going to take you. And then the accrued interest of doing something regularly, not only compounding the knowledge that you have, but then taking you to places that you could never have envisioned early on. But sometimes we don't think that doing something small each day is going to make a difference. And with you, you moved back to New York and you started a morning habit of creating a daily watercolor. And I want to talk about how that dedication to that practice has contributed to the process that we've been talking about for you of embracing the different spectrums of color and emotions and allowing you to feel your way to a place that's fuller and less restrictive. How has the watercolor practice been a component of this process?
So it's inextricably linked, but maybe not in the way that you think or in the way that I realized at the time. It wasn't so much that it was like, I've got to make a watercolor every morning. It was the headline on those 2 years was, I am giving myself the time and space to not achieve, do things with a goal or a prescribed outcome, or to try to get better at something, which was basically how I had lived my entire life up until that moment. And the gift of my 50th year when I moved back to the United States was the time and space to try to do something that wasn't goal-oriented. Now, say that I didn't have the financial buffer that I had, which I worked on like the shoestring, but I did. I could have easily had a job and still afforded myself an hour or something like that. So I had extreme luxury to do it, but I don't want people to feel like it's not possible because it could be 10 minutes a day or 5 minutes a day. And for me, the watercolors and that time spent was less about the creation of the watercolors and the art itself. It was about offering myself at the beginning 10 minutes, then 20 minutes, then half an hour, then I got a studio. It was like hours a day, but of unstructured playtime in which I was allowed to do something for the pleasure of doing it and to let myself be led by it rather than it leading me. And within that expansion then dovetailed into a new way of life from a spiritual perspective in which I still create and I still have desires. So like the notion of the next big Seymour thing, and I say big because it's big for me. It's larger than anything I've undertaken. I still have the desire to see that materialized. And I enjoy putting energy into moving that project along so that it can come into the world. But somewhere halfway along the line, the goal fell away. And energetically in my body, it was palpable. So while I was started with the watercolors and I hadn't like clicked in yet and I hadn't done all the excavating work, I was like on the journey, I was still very frustrated and like leaning forward and like, why isn't it going faster? And it still felt linked to the caterpillar. You know, it was still like, oh, it's been 4 years and people like I'm losing the momentum and the community that I built and the credibility. Like, why is this taking so long? Goal, goal, goal. And and then throughout all of the things that we've been talking about moving forward, you know, the time and space to play without a goal, this new embodied feeling of sitting in discomfort and allowing the discomfort to feel, to allow myself, like everything that we've talked about on this podcast led to the beginning. And I'm like brand new wings on the butterfly, just slowly, slowly, but I'm fully in butterfly mode, but I'm still like a little wobbly on the wings. And is the energy and the way I feel is just completely different. It's like, there's no urgency. There's no place to go. There's nothing to obtain. The project, well, but we still set call dates and we still work on the project. Like I still have all these desires and we still meet, you know, to unravel them. But my sense of self is no longer tied up. Like if it happens, it happens, great. But I was able to unattach my sense of self from any outcome or any goal. Sometimes I feel burdened by those desires. Sometimes I am like, I wish I could get to a point where it's like none of those things had even started and I could just like do daily, just be in the moment every day. And I know that things would happen and things would get done and things would get, we don't, for lack of a better word, accomplished, but not from a place of my intent. And it's really interesting. And I began those and I do want to finish them.
Yeah. Well, the desire to, what it's always like, the desire to be so present in the process that you don't actually have a vision of what the outcome could be.
Yes. And it's always been the way that I am, even before, because people were always like, am I autistic? I've always had like a million diagnoses for the way my brain works. And I think that there's a part of me that's always been so much that. And so when I describe things like right now, we're working with a friend who's an architect to build this thing. And I'm like, he's like, well, what exactly does it look like? And I'm like, well, I don't know. And he's like, well, how do you expect me to build it? I'm like, well, because it's the very nature of us coming together to have this discussion that will birth, like I have a general idea, obviously, because or else I wouldn't be doing it, but it's alive in the moment. It's generative, like we're going to make it together. So what it looks like exactly doesn't really matter. Let's figure that out together.
I saw on your Instagram that you were invited to DC to go to this Intentional Spaces Summit.
That was amazing.
You said that at long last, there are practical words and scientific underpinnings to the work that I and many others have been intuitively doing for years. And I want to know, I mean, A, there's this whole part about being seen and validated and understood as an artist, as a creative, especially when you're doing something that isn't easy to define, boundary breaking, genre bending. So I want to know about what was the presentation that made you feel like you were validated and seen for something that you've been doing intuitively for years.
So that summit, the Intentional Spaces Summit, was amazing. And it was an incredible experience for me. It wasn't specifically, on some level, it was specific to me and to be like, oh, but it was really the expansiveness and the validation that I felt wasn't so much Melissa Unger validation. It was, I felt like finally the work was going to be understood by a broader population, therefore be able to reach more people, and therefore be able to have a very concrete change in society. So the feeling of excitement and validation that I felt was what somebody feels when they have been standing on the edge of a field, seeing a fire coming and screaming at the townspeople, there's a fire coming, there's a fire coming, there's a fire coming, and no one listening. And you're exhausted. And then finally someone is like, oh my God, there's a fire, and let's get the buckets of water to take this fire out. And let's all get together and mobilize and hand the buckets down the thing to get the fire. So it was a feeling of relief at no longer having to be the only one on the edge of the field screaming.
But screaming about what? What is now being recognized? What is being recognized? What is being acknowledged as like a real thing that is important?
Right. So it is a team of neuroscientists and other scientists and designers who are coming together to put clinical and scientific backing, because the world we live in still does not believe anything that can't be measured, which in itself is a shame, because there are many things that are true that cannot be measured by the scientific method. But they are coming together to put scientific underpinnings to the effect of intentional spaces, which the Seymour space was, which is spaces that are meant to heal rather than harm. Our hospitals, for example, are places of care, and they are the least welcoming environments probably on the planet, right? Like, and people are having babies there, people are dying there, and people are coming into the world there, and they are the most sterile antiseptic types of environments. And so a lot of what was going on at the conference, building in a way that is more rounded or more welcoming or safer. Like if you think of the Seymour space, like the light, like everything was very intentional. So it's sort of how the built environment has an effect on our bodies and our well-beings, which almost any architect has been working with that for years. But to an even deeper level, they also, it's an emerging field called neuroaesthetics, which is also how beautiful, harmonious things can have a measurable effect on our well-being. The first budgets that get cut in high schools in the United States or in colleges are the arts. And everyone thinks of the arts as like a nice to have, not a must have. So it would be like flipping it and making that's a must have, not a nice to have. So it was really an inaugural event that brought together a lot of people who are interested in and addressing in various ways all of the stuff that I've been doing in some way or another, consciously or unconsciously,
right,
my whole professional life. So it was basically massive nerdcore. It was, I just like walked into a room and I was like, my people. I just felt like everyone was language. Everyone had the same types of goals. Everybody seeing what I was seeing, whereas normally people are like, I don't get, like even you said it at the top of the podcast, you were like, that has not been my experience. So sometimes I don't understand the language that you're using. And that happens to me a lot. And suddenly I was in a room with a bunch of weirdos that had probably some neurodivergence like me that also saw it back ass words and told stories the way that I did. And even the scientists that were bridging the gap were there because they were the types of people who could speak that language versus other scientists who were hermetic to it.
It sounds amazing. I felt so happy for you to be immersed in an environment where everyone was talking a language that was, that you could understand in such a visceral way, such like a, not like you don't have to like squeeze yourself into a version of yourself that's not fully formed. And so that's kind of what I was getting from the way you described it. I was like, oh, she found, not only did she find her people, but she can connect and amplify her work and her message through this hub.
Like, that's what everybody wants, just to be heard and understood. I think it's universal. It's not even specific to my work. I think some of us take it for granted and some of us don't.
For sure.
You know what I mean? But that feeling of being accepted.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but that's when you're working in a field or in a space using terms that are not common, it could be disorienting. I've had clients who have unusual ways of expressing themselves creatively and were told to not explore that because it wasn't something that made any sense out in the world. And I've had people come knowing that they have these special sensitivities or powers or skills, but they don't want to explore them because it's not easy to describe. So I think that more different ways of describing our uniqueness are necessary for us to feel like we are in the place that we're meant to be in for at least a certain part of our journey. So I wanted to know, based on everything we've explored and also what you're going through right now, who are you becoming? What is the version of yourself that you're becoming more of these
days? It's so cheesy, but I'm becoming more peaceful. I think I'm a human being that lived with a tremendous mm-hmm. amount of chaos emotionally from my earliest days. And I had a very hard time regulating my own emotions. And there's been a lot of chaos. And then I inadvertently created more chaos on top of that. Like, even though I loved it, it was a joyful cacophony. I don't regret any of it. And I still have that. It's all still alive in me. But I feel really peaceful. Like, I feel, I wish there was another word. It's funny. My friend Jill, instead of saying easy, she used the word easeful the other day, kind of accidentally. I was like, is easeful even a word? And then it really stuck with me because it has the word full in it also, like full of ease.
Yes.
You know what I mean? The same way that grief is not a dirty word and sadness is not a dirty word, things being easy, that doesn't have to be a negative thing. I think in our culture, we're like, I certainly thought that if it wasn't hard, it wasn't worth doing. If I wasn't overcoming something or if I wasn't proving something, then I must not be trying or it must not be worth it. And now I understand that it can be easeful. It's not one or the other.
Yes.
It's like, and still being creative forever and still doing stuff and still learning. But also, I always say this in dramatic fashion, there's no going back for me. Like, if I couldn't afford to live in New York, like, I would live anywhere that was less expensive, even if I didn't know a soul, to not have to put myself in the situation of that kind of panic struggle. I can't do that to my body again. Mm. So my goal is really peace, and everything else will have to fit into the embodied feeling that I feel, you know. Does that answer
it? Yes, it's perfect. It's perfect. Well, thank you so much, Melissa, for being here in your unique way. And I really do. I adore you. I want to see you more. I want to have these conversations all the time. So thank you so much.
I adore you too. And thank you for being such a great interviewer and listener. The way you mirror back the things that I say is very, it's not an easy thing to do because I know my way of expressing myself is a little strange sometimes. And I you're really very good at it and it makes me feel heard. So thank you.
I am so appreciative of having your time and your attention and would love to hear anything you have to say, any feedback, any questions, any requests. You can leave me a voice message if you go to speakpipe.com/onbecoming. That's speakpipe, speakpipe.com/onbecoming. I promise to get back to you. If this podcast has touched you, inspired you, transformed you in any way, it would mean the world to me if you would leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast listening platform.